I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Wendy Johnson. She's medical director at La Familia Medical Center, and we're here today to talk about mental health. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So let's talk about access to mental health services and the kinds of mental health problems we have in society. Everybody knows about cancer, diabetes, and heart disease, but mental health problems are, in a way, at least for people who aren't involved in that world, a little harder to understand.
Yeah, I think we go in waves. I think there's things happen, like tragedies happen, ranging from the Robin Williams suicide, the mass shootings, the Santa Barbara shooting, the Philip Seymour Hoffman death. And all of a sudden, we shine a spotlight for a couple of weeks on depression and suicide, for example, or on other kinds of mental health problems, or PTSD, for example, with all our returning service men and women, or on substance abuse. And we kind of wring our hands a little bit about the access to treatment, and it's true that our access to treatment is not good, but I think we have to look a little deeper at what some of the problems are around why we have such problems, such stigmatization of mental health issues, why there's so many people that are essentially self-medicating with illegal substances for some of their mental health illnesses. And even if we had kind of 100% access to quote-unquote treatment, the fact is that there's no kind of magic bullet for mental health disorders. I think, really have to look at a little bit our culture and community and how we as a community are connected to each other or not connected to each other, and how we treat people with depression and how we treat people with other kinds of mental disorders or substance abuse disorders.
It seems like there's an analogy to other kinds of diseases. Like, you might have a predisposition to diabetes, but you might not get it unless your diet is a diabetes-promoting diet.
Right.
And with mental health, you might have a predisposition. I mean, I know some people, they have every reason in the world to be depressed. They're the most cheerful people ever. They're just, like, constitutionally cheerful.
Absolutely.
We envy people like that.
Yeah.
And there they go. But there are other people, many of us, who have a predisposition toward maybe depression or whatever, or anxiety. But the social circumstances that we're in can really make it manifest or not.
Right. That's a great example. I've lived in a lot of other countries. I've lived in Africa and Mozambique. I've lived in Chile and South America. And there have been cross-national studies of schizophrenia, for example. Schizophrenia is pretty well established that exactly what you say. People have a disposition for schizophrenia, even a genetic disposition possibly for schizophrenia, or possibly there's some environmental triggers. But we know that schizophrenia is something that across all cultures people do have. There's some incidence of it across all cultures. But when you do a study of schizophrenics across many countries, interestingly, richer countries have higher prevalence of schizophrenia. And over time, schizophrenics tend to do worse in wealthier countries than in poorer countries. It's not known.
Why is that?
Well, I don't think anyone really knows about, and same thing for depression, same thing for these. There's really big variations, for example, between the United States on one end of the spectrum and Italy on the other end of the spectrum. Those are two countries that economically are sort of both rich countries, but rates of depression are much lower in Italy than they are in the United States. In general, again, even for depression, poorer countries have less prevalence and less severity of those kinds of mental disorders than richer countries. On the whole, there are exceptions to that. But now I'm just saying my hunch from having lived in many different countries and many different cultures is that that has something to do with community cohesion and the way mental illness is sort of treated within the community. In Shona, where the area I lived in Mozambique, people speak a kind of dialect of Shona. And in Shona, when I greet you, if I know you, I say, how are you? And you say to me, well, I don't know. I'm okay if you're okay. How are you? And I say, well, I'm okay. And then there's this whole long greeting about how did you sleep? How is your family? How are your children? And it really is a is a ritualized thing, but it comes from a place of, there's a Zulu word called Ubuntu, which means basically that my well-being is caught up in your well-being, that I can't be well if my community is not well. And I think that we don't really have that value in our culture very much.
Well, no, I mean, and it's a, it sounds like, I mean, that overemphasis that we have on competition. I mean, competition is fine. There's competition in all the kingdoms of, you know, life on the planet Earth.
Right.
But the overemphasis on that and individualism, I would think, wouldn't be very good for our mental health as a society.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing that happens in the United States is we have these silos, these very interesting kind of subcultures, if you will. And so, you know, I personally think that anyone who shoots, goes into a crowded, you know, camp, college campus or whatever, and kills a bunch of people, even one person, is by definition mentally ill. That is not the accepted medical, you know, terminology for that. I mean, they have to meet these DSM-5 criteria, etc. But I think as a culture, you know, there's a Venn diagram that interacts here of violence and gun availability and kind of the acceptance of violence in our culture with mental illness. And so, you know, going back to the Santa Barbara shooting, that person had what I would call kind of mentally ill, misogynist views that were reinforced by a subculture. He could feel normal. He could feel like his way of being was okay and was accepted by a certain group of people. I think in contrast, there's cultures that, you know, we have so many examples in our culture of how violence is sanctioned. You know, Obama just admitted we tortured people in the Middle East. We're one of the few countries left that condone the death penalty. All the state-sponsored violence that we're seeing right now with the police shootings. People who look to, who are, have those tendencies can look at that and see that that's a normal thing. But there's many cultures that don't see that as a normal thing. And so if I have those tendencies, they're sort of squashed early in my life, hopefully. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, I'm talking about violence and mental illness and how they go together, but I think it also has a lot to do with how we sort of embrace people who have any kind of illness, really, or any kind of, you know, deviant thinking that makes their life a little difficult, or depression even, and how we, you know, work with them inside of a community versus kind of isolate them and put them aside. And I think our culture tends to put people aside a lot more.
Yeah, and we fear people who have certain mental illnesses, and as you say, we don't embrace them. But I think there's also another thing, which is that on some level, I think a lot of Americans who are so caught up with this idea that you can do anything you want to do and be anything you want to be, if you're depressed, you can just think yourself out of it. And that's not always the case.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because there was this big, you know, hubbub over Henry Rollins and his thing online. I don't know if you caught that, but he wrote a letter, basically, or a something online that said that he thought Robin Williams was a coward. And another journalist I really respect, Greg Palast, also just wrote something that said that he thought that, you know, Robin Williams was a victim of this happy industry that he was a part of and selling happiness. And, you know, basically he was just a little bit sad. And I think anyone who dismisses depression as just being a little bit sad, or who treats depressed people like, oh, why don't you just buck up, has never been depressed or has had never been really close to a very depressed person. I mean, there's a lot of really great literature about what it's like to be depressed, but you know, it's definitely a physical feeling. It's a physical feeling of not being able to get out of a hole, and maybe not even desiring to get out of the hole, losing all the desire to kind of go on in life. So when you tell somebody who's depressed, I want you to just cheer up, you know, it's a real disconnect. That doesn't compute to the person who's depressed. So there is certainly, you know, a role, going back to how we, where we started, for formal mental health treatment. I mean, we need to improve that, and we need to make sure that people who are in those situations get connected to professional treatment.
And another part of that, I mean, when you look at depression, there was a wonderful writer who was a psychiatrist who we had on the show a few years ago, who wrote a book about the change of the psychiatric profession, which used to be you see patients and talk to them, and then it became you have 15 minutes with them to dispense antidepressants, and that is the extent of your relationship with them.
Right.
So even when there is access to mental health treatment, and there's not always, but even when there is, you know, there's this feeling that maybe we're all kind of like commodities in the system, like we're on an assembly line, and when we get to the, you know, to a certain place, they fill our cup with pills, and then we keep on going.
Exactly right. I mean, in my practice, I see a lot of people with mental disorders that are at the end of their rope, and they're living in really disjointed families. They're very alone. They do not have communities for the most part around them, and they want a quick fix because our society sells them this idea that there is a quick fix. So they want, you know, a benzodiazepine, Xanax, for their anxiety. They want something that's going to say, I'm anxious and I need something right now to make me not anxious. Because I am told in many ways, kind of directly and indirectly, that that's what medical sort of mental health treatment promises. And the drug companies, I think, are partly responsible for that. You know, if you really look at the studies for antidepressants, for example, they're actually not that much better than placebo. I am not saying that that's, you know, some people really do well with antidepressants. Some people really need antidepressants, even if, especially for short periods or even for long periods. But really, they're not the magic bullet. And it really needs to be part of a community response to mental health, as well as a holistic health response to mental health that has to include things like exercise, like talk therapy, like other kinds of and even just having a relationship with somebody. You know, the recent flux in our behavioral health system here in New Mexico, I think, has, whether or not the people who are providing those behavioral health services now are good or bad or better than the people who were doing it before, I think we can all agree that disrupting a relationship you have with a provider that you feel close to is really devastating for somebody who's struggling with a serious mental health problem.
And I guess that's what I mean about the kind of assembly line thing. It's like, oh, we're just going to take away your therapist and give you a different one, as if it were the same, as if it were a pill, as if a person were a pill.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to another problem with our healthcare system in general, which, you know, now under Obamacare, there is mandated coverage for mental health conditions. However, specifically what that coverage is really variable, state to state, insurance company to insurance company. And whether or not I, as a therapist, accept, you know, all those Medicaid insurances, we have a terrible problem in this town with access to substance abuse treatment, with access to other kinds of mental health treatment, because a lot of the folks in this town don't accept all those insurances, or a lot of the insurances don't really cover long-term therapy, which, you know, is a really good treatment for a lot of these conditions.
We're talking to Wendy Johnson from La Familia Medical Center. So what are you seeing in La Familia in terms of mental health problems?
Well, at La Familia, you know, we are a holistic, primary care, family-centered medical clinic. So we really have programs to deal with the whole person. We don't just do substance abuse treatment. We don't just do mental health treatment. But, you know, we take our patients as kind of a whole person, and we provide integrated behavioral health treatment within that setting. And what that means usually is working with people to understand what they need in terms of if it's medication, if it's therapy, and if they really need long-term therapy, we refer them to other places in the community that are more set up to do that kind of thing. And we have a lot of places in the community that are set up, and with our help, we can get people into those services. It is pretty difficult when people just knock on the door sometimes to get into those services from outside. And we can work with them to figure out which mix of services is really going to be the best for them. We also do a Suboxone program, a substance abuse treatment program, especially for pregnant women who are using opioids or heroin. And again, that's kind of incorporated into their prenatal care. So we take care of folks as in kind of a holistic way. And if people come to us pregnant and also using opioids, then we try to get them into substance abuse treatment and deal with that problem. And most of the folks really welcome that and really... The problem is not that they don't want to get into treatment. The problem is that they haven't found an accessible way to do it.
You were talking before about how in some countries, there's because there is a more socially cohesive structure, that really helps people's sense of their own mental health and above all, connection. Do you see within Santa Fe's any subcultures where there's something like that going on?
Well, Santa Fe is a funny place, right? Because we have a great emphasis on holistic medicine here, and you can get an alternative treatments. And if you have money, certainly, you can access all kinds of different healthcare and mental health treatment modalities. If you don't have money, it's kind of a different story. And I think that of all the places I've lived in terms of community cohesiveness, I see Santa Fe as having a lot of different layers and a lot of different segments and silos, and we don't really communicate across those silos very well, I don't think. We have silos based on race, based on migration and immigrants, based on class, and I think they're pretty defined here, and it's, you know, the patient population that I deal with at La Familia, which, you know, at La Familia we do accept anybody to come in, but we have a lot of folks who don't have other resources that come to La Familia. And we have a lot of undocumented immigrants. We have a lot of folks who are marginalized. And, you know, they can't access the same kinds of things that you might hear, you know, talked about on the radio, that different kinds of alternative therapies that are available to a lot of us.
Right. No, I mean, I guess what I was asking was, do you see communities or subcultures where the group or the extended family
is
kind of preventing some of the worst mental health situations?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I don't see that as much because it doesn't come into me. But what I do, I can talk about the flip side, is that a lot of the folks that I see that are the folks I was talking about before who are at really the end of their ropes and they want that magic bullet and they don't have the resources to access kind of the long-term therapy are very isolated people. They're people who, for economic reasons, for other kinds of familial, you know, stressors, they're alone. They don't have that community. I would say much less often do I see somebody who has a very strong community and very cohesive community in that situation. Not to say they don't have mental health problems, but into that kind of desperate desperation kind of place. And so I do think that speaks to there are subcultures. You know, we have the Hispanic tradition here, which is very strong in community, very strong. I went to the Dixon Fiestas, and that was super fun. And you see all these people, and it's I mean, just to pick out Dixon, but there's a lot of New Mexican towns that are like this. You know, Dixon has a lot of recent influx of, you know, transplants that have come in, bought farms. And then there's the old Hispanic families that have been there for 400 years. And I was really struck at the fiestas how both of those groups really form a very cohesive community up there.
There's nothing like feeling that you belong.
Right. Yeah. And I think that we have a history, and, you know, we're learning more and more about how these histories of trauma and histories of colonization, of oppression, actually affect your DNA and can lead to mental health problems. I mean, we look at the Navajo Nation and the higher rates of substance abuse and depression in certain indigenous communities, in certain other kinds of oppressed communities. And we're learning more and more this thing called historical trauma. The fact that, you know, the trauma of my ancestors can actually alter the DNA that's passed on to me and make me, as you said, more susceptible to those things. And then add to that the isolation, the oppression that still continues today, and the availability of drugs or alcohol or guns or whatever it might be, and you have a situation where it's like a powder keg ready to go off.
Yeah. If anybody's listening right now and they are in the position or know somebody who's in the position of feeling isolated, scared, depressed, things like that, what are a few things that they could do here in this town?
Well, I think that, you know, if you know somebody in that situation, I think a non-judgmental attitude towards their situation is probably the best thing. So being there for people, not trying to give them, you know, oh, if you just do this, you'll just cheer up, or why don't you just get through? But just being there as somebody who's willing to listen to what they're going through, or just willing to be with them and sit with them. I mean, sometimes it's really difficult for people to open up about traumatic things that have happened to them, or they feel like, maybe I don't have any reason to be depressed, so I'm not. But just having that kind of person to just sit with you, to just be with you, is really powerful. Beyond that, in terms of our kind of medical system and mental health system here, the first step, especially if somebody's in crisis, if somebody's you know, thinking about harming themselves or harming others, I think is to call the New Mexico Mental Health Hotline. And that's available 24/7, and the number is 855-662-7474.
855 is a toll-free area code?
Yeah, 855-662-7474. So, and that can be found online. You know, depending on what problems people are having, there's a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous groups that meet in the area. There are options for substance abuse treatment. There's a sobering center over at St. Vincent's. There's the Guidance Center, which has a great array of mental health services for folks. We have a lot of different services in Santa Fe, but that's a good clearinghouse number to start with to find out what's available. And especially if somebody's in crisis, that's a great number to call.
Wendy Johnson is medical director at La Familia Medical Center. It's just great to have you back on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's always fun to be here.